only moved to 4 tiers, but you remember how much
you think we are never back.
My name is Jimmy. Jimmy Kinahan.
You can be sure I will never stop believing.
What? McManus. Her husband was the head of the sugar factory. Old friends of your parents. I was down visiting her the other day.
It's last summer past. Italy are playing the US tonight in the World Cup. But I'm at Castleknock College for my school reunion.
You did? No, we were telling you. My name is Peter. Great to see you.
Good to see Eamon.
Six of us, all friends, left here to become priests. None of us were ordained.
Dreaming of spring. Close your eyes.
I met up with them again last summer, some of them for the first time in a long, long time. But this is mostly my story, and the story of where I went when I left Castleknock to become a monk.
Remember Pat in the parlour? That guy used the sacristan.
Yeah,
that's right,
yeah.
All I remember about that parlour was I had a cousin who was in sixth year.
Baby, you can never
guided me like the rest of us.
What really brought me in was that I read Thomas Merton and the poem, you know, The Less Travelled Road, if you read those profiles, that really put me, I used to read, you know, Temptation, we used to read the Gospel, I used to read the Gospel from second year on, and I used to read the four Gospels every year. Mm. But the thing that struck me was, and it's ironic, was that Jesus asked, this young man came up to Jesus and said, you know, Master, what can I do, you know, and he says, give up everything.
Follow me.
And the young fellow went away and said, oh, not really. Yeah. And that struck a chord with me because we were, all of us were very privileged, what we brought up, and I said, you know, maybe that's a message to me.
I was exactly the same. It was this perfection thing. This was the ultimate call.
Yes, yes,
and if you were going to do it right. It was a bit like being a rugby player, wasn't it?
Go in, tackle, do the business, you know. Yeah, it was incredible.
The Cistercians or the Vincentians, it was all part of an idealism of the 60s.
You were. I mean,
but it was a continuation, as we all said, of what we did in school. You know, you said that, Pete. It was a continuation. We went into a regime, we got up in the morning, everything was organised for us.
Yeah. I got to stage now where, for me, love of God is what's important, and love of people. Yeah. Whereas when we were young, we were going to do, and we were going to give up, and we were going to do. Yes. Whereas now it's not what we do. But we have to surrender ourselves to God's love and experience His love, and only from then. And that's what I've learned. I mean, I often look back and say, now, had I been a priest, you know, I mean, first thing I said, sure, I would have been a hopeless priest. But Jesus says somewhere, He says, you haven't chosen me, I have chosen you. Yeah. So I often wonder, you know, people say, well, should I, maybe I left a priest, maybe he wanted to be a priest. But it wasn't my choice. But I chose to come out.
It just struck me, everybody seems to have read Thomas Merton.
Did you not read him?
I said, every one of us. That's interesting. It was,
but he was an iconic figure in the 60s.
He'd come back from the war and gone into the Gethsemane monastery. Yeah. And it's fun that we never said to him, have you read that book?
That's right.
Isn't that interesting? Right, yeah. We might have shared a lot of other books.
But I think, too, that perhaps society was much simpler in the 60s. And I think that if you had feelings of wanting to detach, well, the only avenue open to you was in the church. Nowadays, there are many alternatives available.
Right. Yes.
You know, I mean, both within the church and outside the church. if you want to have a more spiritual life.
It was a radical option, wasn't it? I mean, when you think of it that way.
But there was no other option, really, was
there?
It was very radical what we did.
Yes, for you two, but for the four of us, no.
I mean, most people thought we were mad, even in those days. Why the hell would you do that, you know?
I was pretty shocked and taken aback.
But we were mad.
But I remember going to a tennis club dance the week before I went. You know, and saying goodbye to everybody and trying to get a bird out in a tennis court and do things that I'd never done. I said, my time is up. Come on, I'm going off to the monastery. So that was kind of scary.
I'd ask if that actually happened, yeah.
Last month, I went back to where I went when I left Castlenock, back to Mellifont Abbey, County Louth. There were two other novices who joined with me that year.
Tell me where we are.
Well, we're just outside the public entrance to the church in Mellifont Abbey in Cullen, County Louth. And it's just gone, finished the mid-morning prayer at noon. And they're reflecting now. Monks are reflecting before they go in for their midday meal. And that's where we are now.
And when did you come here?
I came here in 1964. The September 1964, 40 years ago. And, well, 42 years ago. So it's quite... I haven't been here for many, many years, and it's quite nostalgic. I don't think nostalgic is the word I feel. It's I can't explain the feeling about it, listening to them pray in there and see them and being part of that. It's part of my life that I haven't forgotten about, you know, and it's just strange, really. Not a strange feeling, but I can't explain the feeling I have about it. And to see all the monks, although it's a silent order, I could see the characters. I know them, and some of them I didn't even speak to for the period I was here, but I know the characters. I could see them, Father Alphonsus from Kerry, and Father Andrew from Scotland, Father Lawrence from Dublin, and they'd be the real Dubs and the Kerry men, you know. It's quite interesting. And some of them, as I said, I never spoke to, but I could communicate with them, and we would know each other very well.
And when you say you'd know their characters, even though you'd never spoken, how would you?
It's strange, I suppose, that the closest analogy I'd give you that blind people can sense people because their other senses are more perceptive. And although we didn't speak, we communicated, and people had their mannerisms, and we had great sense of humour. And I think all of the monks had a fabulous sense of humour, even the silliest things. We could look at laugh at and. When something silly or stupid happened, you could still make it laugh, even though you didn't laugh. I got caught a few times laughing in the wrong place and had to go to chaplain. That's where you go once a week. All the monks gather in front of the abbot and they sort of confess, not their sins, but things that they did wrong. Because if you don't, somebody else will chapter you. And I was a young guy and I got several things. I broke things at work and things like that. And they would... I would confess them before someone else did, you know. So that was quite... And that's the Advent bell now ringing, calling all the monks who are in the fields to come in for their lunch. I came up with my father, and the interesting thing that when we arrived, Father Kevin was the guest master, and I was in my brother's sports car. Why, I don't know. My father gave me a last drive before I entered the monastery, and Father Kevin insisted that I take him for a drive around the block to RD and that to go for a spin, because he'd never been in a sports car. So that was my first memory of coming in, and it was pretty quick. I suppose my father said, we said goodbye, and I gave him my wristwatch, and I was wearing, for whatever reason I don't know, I was wearing cufflinks because I was dressed in a suit and shirt and tie, and I gave him those back, and he said goodbye to me, and he said, if you're ever thinking of leaving, so don't be worried. So I didn't think that a couple of years later I'd be giving him a call to do that, but it wasn't sort of sad or anything. It was start of a new adventure, I suppose, like anybody going into something, a young person going into the army or going off to sea or something like that. There was a challenge, nostalgia of leaving home, but the excitement of a new life, a new world starting out.
Do you think it was sad for him,
for your father?
Yes and no. I suppose it was sad in a sense that I was joining a contemplative order and one of the situations that you don't have visitors. Obviously, for the first period, but that wasn't too much different because it was boarding school, you know. I'd gone to boarding school, so anyone who went to boarding school would know what I'm talking about. But it was sad in that he would have liked, as every Irish family would like to have a priest, he would have preferred if I'd joined the secular priesthood. And then, but that wasn't to be. So, but I think he was sad from that point of view. But he never spoke about it because I tried to talk to him afterwards about what he felt like going home on the car on his own.
I applied late and I hadn't got to. You remember we got our suit in Cleary's.
Yeah.
And mine hadn't arrived. So I had to get all hand-me-down stuff. And the trousers was about three times too big for me.
You bore this cross.
Oh, I bore the cross, exactly. Well said, Brian.
At least you had a suit. All we had was a sort of a canvas underpants. Yeah. Remember it, down to your knees.
I was going to ask.
Big pants, yeah.
They were rough on your skin and everything. Of course, that was
made. Of course, they made out of goat skin with the hair turned in or something.
That was the bed clothes that were made out of that. They were lint. That was canvas as well.
It was, yeah. And straw bed, straw mattress.
The senior novices would make the pillows for the new ones coming in, and they would pummel the straw into it, and you had a like sleeping on a piece of wood,
but it was carved out. You could pummel it in, yeah.
But I thought, I remember when we went up to see you two, I said, these fellas really have it made, you know.
Yeah, they really are.
Quarter to three in the morning.
All day.
It was miserable. No, I wasn't envious.
All sorts of weather all my life, but that year, all sores on the backs of my hands. Yeah, it was so bloody cold up there.
Yes. It's just about the key to the enclosure. Is it the cloister?
We had a special key for that.
Because of the danger that women might get in.
Ray, you're very quiet.
Brian, he wasn't even thinking of women.
That's right, yeah.
He's forceful on higher things.
On higher things.
They were very high things. But do you remember the day coming up? What brought you guys up to see us? Because a whole pile of other vins came up.
It would have been the novice master.
Yeah, Father McGinley.
Father McGinley. Yeah, Father McGinley.
Right, and he thought it was a good thing that we would inspire you, was
it? Well, we came to inspire you two.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In fact, actually, to kind of pull you over, to kind of get you over to the proper vocation after all that. We couldn't be having you in silence. And knowing the two of you particularly, the idea of the two of you going to silence.
Two good rugby players.
Exactly.
Not forever, you know.
Brought his rugby prowess into tackling calves and bullets.
Sheep.
Catch sheep. He'd say, round those up and we tackle them. And this guy was brilliant at tackling them.
I remember I sprained my ankle once doing catching a ram. I remember that. And I had to go into hospital and I hated every minute of it because inside you were just one or the other. But in hospital, I was suddenly And, you know, I was in from the monastery and they were treating you as though you were some sort of a weirdo. And sure, I was only 18 years of age and just out of school, you know. And I was suddenly a sort of a holy man, you know.
Right. They'd come up to you in the hospital if you went. Yeah. And they would say, bless me, Father, for I've seen all this. And then you say a prayer for us, Father. I'm having a very bad life, you know. Forgive me, won't you forgive me? Tell God to forgive me, you know.
Sheep dip.
I remember it now.
To which?
Sheep dip.
Oh, yeah.
I remember the first summer of doing that, dipping all the hundreds of sheep. And behind all that was with the old milking parlours. And I was a city fella coming out to.
We moved back from them.
This is it's a typical farmyard. It's a quadrangle, and it would be part of the old estate. And the monks would have been, in the old days, they would have been, had all here would be in the milking parlours, the old cans, you know, the Alfa Laval cans. I didn't know the
creamery cans,
And up there would be the creamery would come in. The cows would be all housed in winter on the other quadrangle. And this side then would be all the farm machinery. And the back of here is the timber yards, and there were the sawmills up there, and that's where all on the top was the grain. So we'd harvest the grain, and then we'd use the machine to put it up, and then we would turn the grain. This is all new to me as a city guy. Going out, funnily enough, one of the brothers in charge of the milking was a brother Anthony from Dublin. He was a real dub. And although he couldn't talk to me because he could only talk to me through the novice master. He would shout instructions to the liberals and he'd talk to the cows. I'd get the message if I was messing up big time, you know. But it was scary time to get in under a cow. And wash their others and then start putting the milking machines on. That was quite a bit of shock. But it was all new, as any new thing to a young teenager. As you can see across now, that's the Black Hill directly opposite us. And one of my first memories of the first winter here, I used to look after the sheep, and I had quite a huge herd, and I was given the task of bringing a sack of food up to them, because none of the tractors could get up the hill. So I headed off on my trip up the hill, got up way up the top, climbed over the gate, and was distributing the meal into these troughs. And I saw about 250 sheep running towards me, and I had never seen anything like this in my life. I got such a fright, I dropped everything, and apparently I cleared the 6-foot gate getting out over the far side. And then I just heard roars of laughter, because three of the monks were working in the woods, and they watched all this spectacle of this new Dublin city, Jack Ian, running away from sheep. And I suppose years later, or even months later, I was well able to work with them, and was working with cattle and cows and sheep and everything. And it was the first experience of meeting sheep, running from sheep. It's kind of a joke now. Indeed it was. It is about time.
That's a nice day.
Isn't it indeed?
Oh, lovely day, thank God.
And who are you?
John Clayton is my name.
John, Jimmy Kinahan. Were you here way back in...
Oh, Jimmy, we've got to know you now, all right?
Yeah, your face.
Your face comes to me now, all right?
Yeah, how are you?
You were along with what we call him, the Abbot, present Abbot's here now.
Yeah, Augustine, yeah, that's right. Yeah, we joined together, yeah.
That's right. Remember, there was 3 years here that time.
That's right.
Remember that. Oh, them was good times.
We were just talking about that, yeah.
Oh, there's a big changes here now. Gosh, there's nobody here now.
Right, yeah.
There's nobody here now. But all the old monks are all gone.
Right, yeah.
They're all gone now and all the rest. Oh, you would wander around there and see what the little jobs are.
Okay.
Aye. Lovely. Make sure and shut the gates after the...
Well, indeed, John. Lovely to talk to you again.
Nice to meet you again. Right, fine. I've done the 44 years here now.
Wow.
Oh,
good man. This is how my friend Niall left.
Mine was like a comedy of errors, you know. I mean, it was just gas. I started getting these dreadful headaches.
That's right.
Inside my thing. They sent me then off to a dentist. Some idiot looked into my mouth and saw that I'd got these old fillings. They were the same on either side. I think they were copper or something. They were in our youth. And the guy...
There was a guy from here.
Was he? Yeah. And he looked into my mouth and he says, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll pull out the tooth there. And if the headache goes on that side of your head, then we'll pull out the other one. That's gospel. I swear to God, that's gospel. So needless to say, he took out a tooth, but there was no headache went. So then they sent me down to a fella called Father Doyle. He was in CUS there in Leeson's Marist, and a lovely old man. Mm-hmm. But I remember clearly, I went out the door that day and I was meant to get a bus, but I decided to start hitching. And I was wearing my full regalia, you know, or some sort of a clerical. I can't exactly remember, but I was wearing clerical stuff anyway, of some sort. So I got a lift. I got a lift straight down. So I went to see this fella, Doyle, and he sat down. He said, will you have some breakfast? And we were chatting away. And, of course, we had no meat or fish or eggs for the whole year. But when you were out, you were allowed to do things. So knowing what I was in for, he prepared a big fry, and we sat down at a big fry. And then he spent the whole morning with me and did tests and questionnaires and all sorts of things. So then again, he said to me at the end of it, what do you want to do, Niall? Well, I said, to be honest with you, I'd really like to leave, but I feel a bit guilty about wanting to leave because maybe I'm giving in too much. He says, look, I spent 2 minutes with you and I knew you should never be there. But he said, I knew you wouldn't believe me if I said that. So I put you through the whole rigors and the answer is exactly the same. Get the hell out of there and don't come back. Yeah, yeah. Now, he didn't say you don't have a vocation to be a priest or anything. It was just I didn't have the vocation to be in there. So we sort of left it. That we would review the situation in the future. And, of course, I reviewed it very quickly. And so I wasn't going back anywhere. Yeah, I wasn't going. When I came back then, they asked me to wait for 2 weeks, I think, or something like that, which I did. And they were very kind, very nice. There was no effort to keep me there. They just accepted it completely and were very kind, very nice.
And in all the time you were in here, you had no real idea what was going on outside of here.
No, we were totally oblivious to anything that was going on outside, unless the abbot decided to give some news. Now, they probably have advanced somewhat now, but I would get letters from my sisters and brothers, and my mother would send me clippings of my brother playing rugby and things like that, and something going on. And in fact, when I did leave, I remember My father collected me in a weird business in town, and he parked on O'Connell Bridge, and I still remember sitting in the car and seeing miniskirts for the first time. It's a bit of a shock to the system because they had only come in a couple of years since I had gone in, and it was quite a shock to the system, you know. And they didn't seem to miss not having news. It's a piece of tranquility in the middle of a mad world, and still here I can still get that sense of feeling of total tranquility. You can hear the breeze and the wind and the birds and animals around you, and it's so peaceful.
And another thing you were saying earlier too about coming in here and the notion of silence itself, and people, and the woman and the person had said to you about you being a coward to come in here.
Well, yeah, it was very interesting. A lot of people criticised me, saying that it was escapism. Going into priesthood is escapism, but going into a monastery was real escapism. And when I came out, I met my friend's mother, who used to write to me and criticise me. She was nice, she was a very devout, religious person, but she just said I was a coward running away from life. And I explained to her that from the time I got up in the morning right through the whole day, I had no distractions about. I had to worry about my food, clothes, roof over my head. I had no job to distract me during the day. I had no family. I had no wife or children to distract me throughout my life. The whole thing was all about me and my relationship with God and why I was here. So I didn't have a chance to escape anything. I had to examine and justify to myself every minute of my working, living day. Why am I here? Why do I want to be here? So I didn't have a chance of escapism. I think a lot of people don't understand that when they say people are escaping. You're not escaping. You don't have a chance to escape. And I'd wake up in the morning, I'd have to say, why am I here? And I had my justification, my reasons for being here. I had a vocation to, this is what I wanted to spend my life doing, you know.
And how do you feel about it now?
I think that I certainly have that eerie feeling of being back. It's a pleasant feeling. I feel very comfortable with it. It's hard to really describe. I probably feel a bit of guilt that I haven't come up more often to visit them, and I think I would change that now. I'd make it more of an effort. It's so easy to get here, and if you hadn't prompted me to come here, I think I probably wouldn't have. And I think that it will be a new era that I will certainly make more time to come and visit with my family, and that, because it's very much a part of me, and it has been very much part of setting the values I have in life. And in fact, my family would often say that, you know, you're not a monk now, because I have no material interests, and material wealth doesn't really push me in it. They really have to go out and try and get me to buy stuff and that. And I think that has come from here. Maybe it was there before, but this certainly enhanced it. I mean, you see how frugally the monks live here and how content they are. And you could see there in the church the peacefulness on their faces, and they have nothing, but they have no worries either, I suppose, in a sense. Mm-hmm. But they have to. The big worry they have is justifying why they're here. That's the hardest part, justifying why they're here. Every single day they have to ask themselves, what am I doing here? And it's obviously that they believe that they're giving their life up to prayer.
Ross.
Yeah. But it's interesting that a lot of people would have said, if I was in the priesthood and that, and said that you're very selfish. Mm. You were just thinking of yourself, you know, and that. And yet every one of us are married, so that's a massive commitment of unselfishness, if you think about it, because there's none of us in this group that are not married, you know.
I think it was inevitable I went in, sort of. I think I had to go through that. I wouldn't have been able to work myself out the other side, you know what I mean? Yeah. I think I had to go in. Nobody was pushing me, you know what I mean? It was a sort of an inner compulsion. And if I had not followed that, I think I'd have been regretting it forever. Whereas I followed it through and it worked out not to be right. But I wouldn't regard it as a mistake. I think it wasn't right for me in the long term, but I think in the short term it probably gave me a foundation that has been helpful through tough times and good times, you know, since.
What would you say that people would say to us? We were terribly immature. We were idealistic. We went off into this romantic role of the priest up in the mass, saying mass and doing all that type of thing. What would you say about that?
It's a special calling from
going into marriage. I mean, what do you go to get married? I mean, you say we're not busy, we're not selfish, therefore we got married. The reason we got married is because we were selfish. And I think, I mean, it's a bigger question, but do we do anything that isn't selfish? That's a far bigger question.
Yeah, you're getting into philosophy. What's wrong with being selfish?
I'm not saying that.
The self, and you know, you get it the whole thing.
Yeah, but I mean, you got to love yourself before you love anybody.
That's right.
But Jimmy, I find at this part of my life, it's now I have the luxury of being able, I have the children reared, and I'm now able to go into myself and come to grips with myself and love my. I mean, I think in life, I have to love myself, I have to love my God, and I have to love people. But I must love myself. And personally, the most difficult thing, because of this idealistic thing, would be to love myself.
Yeah.
I would have always said, why can't you be different? Why can't you be doing this and doing that and doing that? And then when you don't reach it, you're giving out to yourself. And if I know you accept everything, as it is, and try and live the moment, and everything will change. But you must accept yourself, and accepting yourself, you accept everybody else. This is the way I'm beginning. Yeah. But
there's a tree there with spreads out all over the place. Kids love it, you know.
The third novice who joined that summer stayed on in Mellifont, was ordained, and became Father Augustine, and now Dom Augustine. He's the abbot there.
Who was it entered first? Was it Niall or you?
Niall.
Well, Niall and I entered on the same day.
That's right.
And you came along about a week or two later.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I stayed for my brother's wedding.
Yeah.
That was it.
Yeah. Niall left exactly after a year.
Right.
And then you went a year, was it a year later after that?
A year later,
yeah. And I was on my own then for about 10 years. Things were really tough here. They were, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, it was only after 1969 that the way of life eased up a bit, in that it's the strict rule of silence, Grant, you know.
Don't spoil it all now. But for my time it was tough. Yeah,
it was tough. It was very tough. Yeah, it was very tough.
It was, yeah.
The diet was severe. Our communication was minimal. And today, like, relationship is all about, you know, the ability to communicate. So we were living strange kind of lives. I remember smoking my last cigarette before going to the chapter room to get the novice's habit, and thinking this was the end. And my mother and my youngest sister crying their eyes out at Amiens Street when I was leaving them, you know, thought they'd never see me again.
Right.
And of course, when you crossed the threshold down there, it wasn't a road, it was a dirt track really up to this place. You felt, you know, you were leaving the world behind in no uncertain way. And that was it. You'd never get out again. And it was a good few years before I actually did get out.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But we have a huge plant here now, 1,000 acres. We have a large garden centre. We have a printing press and a farm. And all of these things, you worry about them because the community is diminishing in numbers, or we're aging. And, you know, you ask, I mean, it's not just Mellifont, and many of our communities are asking the same questions. Do we need a huge plant to survive?
Yes.
Like, we're 13 now. I suppose in modern terms that would be the size of three families, perhaps. Three families. Do you need all of this for three families?
Can I ask you, Father, about silence, what it would mean to you?
Silence is an essential part of our living, really, because prayer is our primary apostolate. And for prayer, you need to listen to God, listen to the word of the Lord. And for that, like, large portions of silence are essential, really. And that's silence within oneself, and then silence in the atmosphere and the environment, and by and large we retain that all right. So it really is, you know, it's trying to eliminate all the various noises that go on inside and outside oneself. And they say that a lot of people today find it very difficult to live with silence. That's why you have this proliferation of mobile telephones and people talking everywhere. I mean, there are monks who have their mobile telephones because they're considered essential today. Closely allied with silence is the whole question of solitude, being on one's own, being able to live with yourself. That's important as well. And that raises a big question today too, because I mean, we all have access to internet. How can you be apart, as it were, from the world when you're, you know, at a switch of a button, you can be watching anything at all, you know, on the internet. And the other various means of communication, newspapers, you know, they do. There's always the danger of them impinging too much. I mean, you have to have them on, right? I mean, I don't know what I'd do without a computer, to be honest with you.
Right.
Yeah.
No. What are they, apartments?
They're apartments, there.
Yeah. But you hear the noise of the traffic? Well, look at them there.
Your parents could put you down, you know.
Here's Father Davis. Who hasn't changed? Who hasn't changed? Who hasn't changed a bit?
Have I not, Brian?
No, not
Father,
a bit.
You put up with us. I don't know how you did.
Exactly. I should introduce myself. I couldn't get a name tag.
What did you say,
Ray? I find that very hard to believe.
What?
That was your phrase.
That's what you used to say.
Yes.
Come back to haunt you. We actually realised that when you were trying to deal with 14-year-old snippets like we were then, that you were only about 31 years of age.
No, he was older.
No,
he
was
born in 1929.
Yeah. And then.
So in
1960, what were you?
Well,
31.
You were 31. Yeah, that's what I mean. But when you come to, now that we've all grown up a little bit, and hopefully got a tiny bit of wisdom, realise what an impossible task it was.
Absolutely.
And how young you were.
The snag about it is you didn't realise it was impossible in those years.
No.
That's what made all the difference to me.
Yes, yeah.
But was it impossible?
Nearly.
Yeah.
Well, listen, this is something we want to give you as a little present to... I don't want to bring it down in things, okay, so you want to open it up.
Jimmy.
Just open it up and say, it's a sort of to say that you created something for us that is there, and it's very symbolic, and I'm sure the guys, when they see it, they're going to appreciate it.
Oh, yeah.
It's an acorn turned into an oak tree.
Oh,
and I think that's what you did for us.
Lovely.
And those of us, it certainly had English, and those of us, we never saw you as a dean of discipline, we saw you as a different person. And especially fellas like, you know, who went on, and you gave us a lot of spiritual advice. It was there, and we never got a chance to say thank you for that.
Mm-hmm. Well, 40 years later, better than nothing, isn't it?
There's three criteria for a vocation, and one is that you obviously have to have the spiritual, you have to have the emotional. What is it? Let me see what they are. You have to have the vocation. You have to have the physical, the emotional, and the spiritual. And if any of those are missing, it's a sign from God or whoever you believe in that that's not the place for you, you know? So my health broke down. And when I came back here, I was saying, that's why I went to the abbot, and he was a lovely man. He was very upset. It was like talking to my father, and he was really crying. He said, I'm losing a son. I'm very upset. I'm very, you know, he was really sad. I still remember it. But he... When will I go? And he said, as soon as possible, because once you realise that this is not the place that God wants you to be, you won't be happy here. And I thought, I'll give it a while and see how it goes, you know. But within a day, I had that feeling exactly as you just described of I shouldn't be here. It was just a feeling of real feeling all over of, you know, not in the right place, and I shouldn't be here. And then I couldn't wait, I didn't sleep for about 3 nights, and then I went home on that Saturday. That was on a Tuesday, and I had never had that feeling before of being in a place where I didn't want to be. I did want to be, but it wasn't the place for me. Can you understand? Sometimes you're in relationships, you have the same feeling of you're, you know, it's not the place to be, but you can't explain it. And once then you make the decision to leave the relationship, there's sort of a cloud lifts off your heart and your whole sense. So in those couple of days, I felt that I shouldn't have been here. And funnily enough, although we were all silent, nobody talked, and the word got out, and I would be approached by brothers without saying a word. They would just put their hands on the shoulders and kind of say goodbye and that, you know, because you don't hear when someone leaves. Like Niall, the other guy was with me, when he left, he was there one day, he was gone the next. You don't get a chance to say goodbye. So that's quite traumatic, and I presume there's reasons for that. I could see it now that you could upset an awful lot of other people if you were in. Whereas when somebody leaves, that's just it. It's not mentioned. It's just gone.
Is there ever a part of you that thinks you might have stayed here?
When I left a couple of years afterwards, I used to get nightmares thinking I was back. I used to wake up in a sweat, and this was like anything else. But sometimes that I was wondering what it would be like if I had stayed here. Then I wouldn't have had the wonderful children, I suppose, that I have now. It's a testimony to myself, I suppose, that and that's been part of me that is absolutely crucial to my existence, to have such lovely children. So I don't think I would have. I wouldn't have been part. So I think I go back. I definitely think that it has influenced my life. There's no question about that. It hasn't done me any harm, but it would certainly. Robert Frost, famous poem, "Less Travelled Road," I think reflects me a lot, because throughout my life I've taken things less travelled than other people, and this is one of the paths I took that certainly made my life the way it is.
That's what the last few months have been like, going back, remembering, and having memories jump out of nowhere in front of you.
And this is the graveyard now. I'll walk over here. There's a priest over there. I'm just going to go over and just have a look at some of the gravestones. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Music.
Christmas tune, yeah. That's terse. Before they go back out into fields now, they'll be saying the prayers to go before they go back out.